Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio. Welcome to the Dolcezza Sherber Experience on Full Service Radio. Friends, we are live from the Line Hotel. My name is Violeta Edelman. I own Dolcezza Gelato in Washington, D.C. We make gelato, we make radio. I'm here with my partner in crime,
Rob Duncan.
And today we have our friend Elizabeth Casaus from Somash Fine Foods, specialty tea and coffee expert. These are our two favorite drinks in the world. We obsess over coffee and tea both, so we're very excited to be talking about our favorite two beverages today. I also love wine, I have to say. Rob doesn't, but anyway.
But I'm into the herbal stuff.
We have herbal
stuff in this tea, so I'm good.
Yes, and we're going to be sampling some amazing tea she brought for us here to the studio. I'm excited about it. So how, Elizabeth, how are you today?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm doing fantastically.
Welcome here to DC, Elizabeth. Great to have you on the show.
Always great to see you both. Yeah.
So I want to start with tea, of course, and while tea is brewing here in front of me, since you know it all, give me an introduction of, you know, where are these teas like that you're brewing, where do they come from, and why are they so special?
Absolutely. So one of the things that makes our company Somash so unique is that we source everything in direct relationships. So there are two founders of our company. We were founded in Australia about 13 years ago. Nathan Wakeford was a coffee person. Ben Kelly was a chef. He'd worked all over the world. And they came together seeing that there weren't a lot of high-quality beverages that supported a coffee program. And they wanted to make something cleaner, more delicious, and more sustainable, more impactful, truly. And so Nathan began traveling to origin. He went to Sri Lanka. He did a ton of exploring there, trying to find teas. He travels to Taiwan, China, Japan, all over the world. And so today I'm making a beautiful herbal tea called Orange Osmanthus that's from a private garden in China. And it's very rare. Oftentimes you can find the yellow osmanthus flower. It looks kind of like the little the thing that's inside of a sand dollar when you break it open, those little kind of angels.
Oh, yeah.
It's really pretty.
You know, tea is just, it's one plant, right?
Yes, Camellia sinensis.
Yeah, that's like something that the first time that I heard that, that surprised me because there's so many different types of teas and everything. But the first time that someone told me that, it surprised me because my perception of not knowing all about the plants and the origin and all that, it blew me away that it's one plant and then different, I guess, I don't know what it is, different methods, different fermentation, different time.
Yes.
Different,
oxidation.
Obviously, oxidation. Mm-hmm. That makes it the different from the, I guess, the white teas and to the black
green,
teas.
Oxidized.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So tell us more about that. So there's this plant, Camellia sinensis, is that what it's called?
Yes, exactly.
So there's two primary types, right, that are used? Mm-hmm. When
China Jot and Assam Jot are the two varietals of the same plant.
Okay, and then what happens?
So they were carried.
What are we drinking here?
That's
first?
The orange osmanthus. So that's an herbal. That's not a true tea. That's a tisane. It's a flower that's been infused with hot water.
And that's what tisane means.
Yes.
Huh. It's like a tisane is an infusion of tea.
Of fruit or
it's herbal.
Herbs
it's, or so that's not from that plant, right?
Correct. So it does not contain Camellia sinensis.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm.
It's your chamomile. Is your lavender. Is your all of those. It's the ones that I drink a lot. Infusions. Yeah, this one smells amazing, by the way.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's like so fruital.
Yeah, I get honeysuckle.
Honey, a lot of
almost
honey.
Jasmine, yeah. And it's so floral.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So I meant to say floral, not frutal.
I don't correct it because I think it's adorable.
Yeah, but I am
so
also frugal. That person
actually,
that, you know.
I'll use it later. It's
frutal.
So frutal.
Yes.
Yeah, so frutal.
If you don't know what
it's
I'm talking
futile,
about, then
frutal.
You just don't know.
Or maybe I get angry and I'm like, you're so frutal.
Don't be so flory.
Yeah, I don't know how I'm going to use it, but it smells amazing, whatever that is. Yeah.
I want to make a sorbet or something with this. It would be so beautiful.
Yeah, we've played around with different teas and sorbets, and it's spectacular. What is the tea? We did one with
Hojicha?
Yeah, we've done the hojicha, playing around with that, but obviously the matcha. But I mean, we've done jasmine, but there was stuff that we did with fresh squeeze, like honey tangerine, and then a smoky black tea,
because so you had like the citrus. Luxong. Yeah,
like an oolong, like orange oolong that we've done for tea as we speak.
That. Yeah, I remember that.
It's amazing to spin sorbets of teas.
So I want to
get
go
a lot
back.
Of the notes and the subtleties when you actually bring it down as far as the temperature.
I believe.
In a different form.
Yeah, it totally changes, right? What it brings to it.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to the process.
Yes.
So how important is the terroir on the quality and flavor of the tea?
It's important. So, you know, we place a lot of value on very specific things in terms of terroir in coffee and tea and agriculture. And there are companies that are actually working to disrupt that and working to just create classification systems about what the qualities and the flavors are, good and bad, right?
Like big ag companies that are trying to do that?
No, there's a smaller company.
Not so evil?
I took a course actually at Counterculture Coffee in New York a few months ago, and I'll send you the information afterwards. I can't recall what it was, but it's like, it's an academy of food people and coffee folks.
Ah, so it's not something that's kind of like
it's not a mass
market.
It's
not seen as like a bad thing from the inside. Okay,
exactly. So cool. It's meaning to kind of take the valuation out of it. But higher elevation teas and coffees are generally considered higher quality, right? Because of the altitude, it means that it's warm during the day, the air's a little thinner, and it cools down at night, which helps with the sugar development. So that warm and cool is one of the things that helps create sweetness in coffee and teas.
Which is, that's something that's also similar to wine, right?
Yes, exactly.
That range of temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is creates more sugars?
Yes.
Because of that?
Yes, exactly.
Interesting.
So it just helps with the development of those sugars. It's really interesting. So some of our teas are not incredibly high elevation teas. These premium and reserve teas that we're tasting today would be, because these are some of the most rare teas that are made in the world. They're really unique. They're only picked once a year. They may only have one or two harvests, which are just very unique. But in Sri Lanka, say where we source most of our black tea, because it's close to the equator, they can pick and process and grow tea all year. So that's one of the things. Freshness is really key with tea that you don't see a lot commonly, but that's one of the things where we're unique in that we source and pick and process all year. So we're always making fresh tea.
Yeah, that's a concept that people don't have, right?
No.
So fresh tea, I guess, because also it's like, you know, what's the first thing, at least that I think of when you say tea, is like, you know, Lipton and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it's changed so
it's
far,
dry,
but that's kind of what
commodity
we all grew
tea.
Up. Yeah, commodity tea, mm-hmm. commodity food.
Yeah. So I read that the first tea harvest is obtained 4 to 5 years after planting. Is that so?
That's what I've learned. Yes.
Okay. So what happens if you have bad weather?
You have a really
brine. 6 years.
Well, no, but since, you know, depending on where you are, it will potentially grow again. So in certain parts of the world, again, based on the altitude and the closeness to the equator, tea mostly grows around the equator, and is most, you know, grown and harvested in India, in Sri Lanka, in Asia. So you can pick different harvests throughout the year. And in China, they have a way of differentiating if it was picked before the spring festival or afterwards. So it's not necessarily that you don't get anything for the whole year, like coffee, you sometimes get two crops, but tea can grow, you know, continuously. And the trees actually are valued the older they are, which is unique to coffee. And coffee, you don't want that. They renovate their trees and farms. But in China, there are ancient trees that are 3,000-4,000 years old that have energetic properties that you would love, Rob.
Oh my gosh.
That create psychedelic experiences.
That?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I speaking of psychedelic experiences, I have a friend who was actually on this show a long time ago, and we went to his house for dinner one night, and he's was into Tibetan Buddhism and lived over there a lot and traveled, and he did I participated in a I think it was called a puer tea ceremony,
yes.
where he got out the whole board and the pores and the pores and
yes.
the pores, and it was like nonstop. And I had an altered state of consciousness, not any kind of epiphany or psychedelic state, but it changed my state of mind.
You get tea drunk.
Yeah. I had never experienced it, and I had never heard of that, and it was fascinating. So that to hear that there are tea trees that are 3,000 to 4,000 years old. Mm-hmm. I had no idea.
It's insane.
And that
it's
they're still producing, like, actually they get better.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. Yeah. And talk about, like, you know, the energetic properties, which is like cloudy, nebulous, and all that, but that's
ginseng and stuff like that.
But it's real. I mean,
no, I believe it. Yeah. I mean,
oh, 100%. Whether you see it or not, you know, it is. It's there.
Right. You experience it. No, yeah. But
isn't like that you don't have to touch them. Like when they get that all, like they're not harvested, right? They just. Or am I wrong?
They're hand-picked.
They're hand-picked.
So they're generally, and you know, the best quality of teas are hand-picked, right? Because then you do less sorting at that point if you have quality pickers.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like the coffee cherry, right? You pick the ripe cherry off the by hand.
Yes, and it's actually the reverse for tea because you want the young leaves. You want the small leaves. Uh-huh. You don't pick from the whole bush. Just pick from the fresh growth.
Uh-huh.
The young leaves are more flavorful and more sweet.
With the oils.
The older ones are bigger. They've had more time to photosynthesize, so they'll be more bitter and astringent and brisk. So those keep the plant alive and help it photosynthesize, but that's called coarse leaf, and you don't want that in your tea. That's not going to be as sweet and delicious.
And I imagine, you know, I was just reading yesterday on the whole thing of terpenes, mm-hmm. and how that's becoming a thing now, especially within the cannabis world. But like everything, you're basically another word for the terpenes are essential oils. And I wonder if that is there a conversation on terpenes and everything that are in the world of tea right now, like this terpene. Gives this particular flavor because that right
can
now.
Can you explain?
What I mean by terpenes, and I don't pretend to know a lot about it, but just the basic stuff of what makes a lemon lemony is the terpenes inside the lemon, or the pine tree piney is the terpenes, and essentially, like I said before, another word for terpenes are the essential oils, mm-hmm. and so that's something that people are talking about in cannabis, where you have the two divisions of the indica. And the sativa actually have third called ruderalis. But before people would grow indica for certain effects, sativa for certain effects. But now they're talking about the future of genetics and everything is you grow specifically for certain essential oils or terpenes. And that's what you're going to start targeting. And I just wondered if that translates over to like coffee or tea. But
I'm unfamiliar in that aspect. I've only heard it, you know, being used in terms of cannabis. But if that's a universal... you know, terminology, and it's just related to the oils, then
right.
I'm sure that's important. We talk a lot about amino acids and flavonoids and flavanols in teas.
Right. So amino acids, so what is flavonoids and flavanols?
So those are both amino acids that provide different flavor characteristics to the tea. You know, like we have a beautiful tea that's called GABA Oolong, and GABA is an acronym for one of the most important amino acids that's in every tea. It's GABA amino butyric acid. And that provides a lot of flavor, but in higher doses, such as this tea, it actually creates relaxation, it helps with your circulation, it can promote restful sleep, it actually kind of absorbs caffeine. If you've had too much coffee, you know, I recommend it to baristas a lot, it actually mellows you out. It's really nice.
Wow, it's incredible. The world of tea and like here, I guess in America, it's like we really... have no clue to what tea means to the tea drinking countries
no.
or the tea growing because it's such a ritual and it's such a ceremony and it's almost like food is medicine with stuff like tea.
100%.
Yeah.
So wow. Rob was talking about the rituals. Have you participated in any tea rituals? Have you been to...
I have. I haven't... in terms of what you were talking about experiencing puree tea, I've done that.
Have you been tea drunk before?
I've been a little tea drunk, not super drunk.
Tea tipsy.
Tea tipsy, that's a perfect way to say it. A little bit, but I, you know, sort of my best experiences are spending time with Nathan drinking tea, and sometimes that's just in his living room, and, you know, we're just talking, and he's doing it, and it's second nature, you know, and it's always with really nice teaware, and it's just very special, and it's a really... meaningful way to connect and kind of like realign yourself.
You know, it's like that thing that you say, like it's just second nature. That's that. Now that you say that, that's something I remember also from that night. Was there's a million things going on with it, but he didn't break conversation whatsoever. Just moving this over here, pouring this water through mm-hmm. that wash, and then moving the filter from there. And it was like a beautiful dance almost with his tea and his pitchers of hot water and the ceramic cups and all that.
Are the puer ceremonies, are they mostly done in Japan, China?
It's China, right?
China. Mm-hmm. China. Yeah.
And it's, so that tea it's actually a cake of tea usually, and it's aged and fermented, and we sell them. We also have like a loose leaf version that's a younger sort of like a precursor to that, that's called an Echa style, but they're cakes and you usually have a special knife to cut it. And
so is that looked down upon? Like yep. Like the, when you say that it's caked and it's fermented, no. does that translate to bad? Like
no,
negative?
It translates to good.
Huh.
They're very highly prized, and sometimes they're aged for decades or more, and they can be gifts from the government. They're considered to be very special.
It's incredible. It's like wherever you scratch, there's so much depth of information, you know, that you would have never imagined that existed. And just talking about tea, I mean, and coffee and cannabis and food and baking and cheese and wine, etc.
Yeah. So going back to tea.
Yes.
So some is oxidized, right? And there's others that are non-oxidized. So what are the results of this process? And how? Tell me more about, you know, what different types of tea are out there.
Absolutely. So I had the incredible opportunity in December to go to Sri Lanka to see Ahinsa, which is where all of our black tea for our classics are made.
Ahinsa? What is Ahinsa?
It's non-violence, right?
That's what it means. It means non-violence.
I was reading on the website. I want you to talk about more about this collaboration because it's incredible.
It was one of the best weeks of my life. So we flew to Sri Lanka. You drive out into the country, you know, up and down mountains. It's kind of rough terrain, and we get there and it's paradise. It's really a rainforest where tea is being grown. And the person that owns it we call him the doctor, or his name is Pia. And he's worked and lived all over the world. He helped to kick Monsanto out of Sri Lanka. He has a really massive legacy of doing incredible things for the environment and for his community. So we got there, and we have the tea factory. It actually backs up to a UNESCO World Heritage Site, a protected forest sanctuary. And I don't know anywhere in America where you can go to a factory and have it back up to a...
That would be awesome to have that. Dolcetta factory.
Welcome to my backyard.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I know. Mine too, right? My little garden. Yeah. So I got to see everything from the picking all the way through the manufacturing. And one of the things that's, I think, the most exciting is we manufacture our own tea. And we're one of the few companies in the entire world that does that. Most people just go, you know, work with brokers and buy what they like the flavor of. While we were there, Nathan's talking to Pia about the temperature and multiple stages of drying and all these different aspects, and we're tweaking it and the recipe, and you can smell the difference. It was incredible. So
So that's a factory that they own, that Somaj owns there?
No, we don't own it because... I don't know.
They purchase 50% more or less of their production. Mm-hmm. And this professor is helping transforming the region into more of an organic, sustainable tea production region.
100%. Wow. And it's the most biodiverse place. They've got probably at least 150 different plants and fruits and things growing there. So that all impacts the flavor of the tea. It just absorbs these flavors. It's incredible. So they pick it. That's the first step. And then there's a lot of sorting that happens between picking and the withering, which is the next step. And that really is sort of like a thoughtful evaporation of some of the moisture from the leaves. The point of that is that the next step, which is rolling, when they roll the leaves on basically in a machine where they break the internal cell structure, but they don't break the leaves. That's important. And that's what will release the fluid later, when the tea liquor, when you're going to brew it later, if that's done properly. So they evaporate some of the moisture, withering in these big tanks with fans underneath them. Then they go downstairs to the rolling machine, and then that's when oxidizing would happen if it's going to be an oolong tea or a black tea. So if it's a green tea, before they do the rolling, they would actually apply some kind of heat, either steam or put it in almost like a rice dryer, so that you'd hit the kill green stage, which is what stops any of the enzymes from oxidizing. So that's the difference between green and black.
So when it oxidizes, it goes black.
Correct.
And then to keep it green, then you do that.
You apply heat. Right. It's just like cutting into an apple, or, you know, metal being cut and getting, you know, wet and rusting. Huh. It's all oxidation. It's all the same.
Right, right.
So on top of that, this is done in a non-violent spirit, right?
Yes.
So I love that.
So when you say the non-violent spirit, it's like you're you're praying over, or you're chanting over the process, like for the tea leaves, or
it's just what it... It's more about the community, the philosophy.
Okay, about the surrounding community as far as the process and the how.
Yes. So Sri Lanka is a largely Buddhist country. So there, and when we were there, actually, they were they had just done the green leaf programs, which we help sponsor to help incentivize better quality. And then there's an award who goes to the farmer who had the best quality tea that year. All these kind of different little things, and they actually did have an entire night of chanting. With, you know, speakers and microphones, and all the families and the communities from the farm that came there. I know at the last count, we'd worked with more than 150 farms to help convert from conventional to organic farming with Ahinsa, which is incredible. They don't buy any kind of fertilizers or chemicals or bring anything in. They make their own special compost and they carry it around the farm to nourish the trees.
That's amazing to be involved in what you're doing as far as like, and you're pouring us this hot water over the tea, but for you directly, there's so much more that goes into that. That's incredible to be able to have that mission-based connected with a product that you sell.
It's a dream come true.
Yeah, because it really is. It really is this thing of direct action as far as like, you know what, and I think that everybody or a lot of people probably at this stage are like done with looking for the solutions from the government. And now it's like, okay, you can use your business that you have as to create that action or that
and
consequence.
I think that
that's incredible.
When you mentioned that Nathan founded the company in the early 2000s, I think that was the time that's when we started too, in which we all saw that there was no good food around, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of new energy. And now everyone is saying, you know, directly from the source, farm to table, this, that, sustainable. But
it's a lot of smoke screen. It's a lot
of
smoke.
You guys walk the walk, a lot
of
buzzwords. Yeah, we actually, we tend to not talk about it as much, but we actually do it. And that's so powerful. I always say, you know, I came into food.
And you make
for
money
love.
At the same time, because that's another part that is very, very important.
It's extremely important to be able to empower the mission. That's how you empower
it
with the money that you have.
And with the people around you, right? Yeah. You have inspiration, you have shared values. You know, we get together and it's like being a family. It's like the first time I met Nathan, we just were connected and we looked at each other and said, I think we should work together. You know, and that's not necessarily what you say in an interview for a high-level job, right?
Very typical.
You say, I've got a lot of opportunities, and, you know, I've got this massive book of business and all these things. And we just had a heart-to-heart, and we talked a little bit about business, and, you know, we figured out how to do it in a way that was sustainable, and we both had opportunities, and it really is a dream come true. And it's things like this company and, you know, all of my previous experiences that keep me connected with folks like you and Violetta that really drive me to keep going, right? That's the thing that makes you feel like you're really in alignment and you're doing something you love with people that you love.
So, so, so important, because I think most of the people, it's so easy to get stuck in the grind.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of grind in life.
In D.C., in New York, with family.
Yeah, and obligations and the bills and work and the schedules and things are getting faster and faster and busier, you know. So that's so important to find those places where you go to work, and obviously there's stress involved in whatever dream job you have or not, but to be able to have that at the end of the day, touch that like part of the satisfaction beyond just the financial pocketbook is so, so, so important.
That's the key.
Yeah, it is.
You can't just do one or the other, for me at least.
No,
I want it to be something that I'm excited to share with the people I love and something that I enjoy. You know, I would never sell Hoover vacuum parts, you know.
Exactly.
I want to have an impact by selling tea, you know, on all these families in Sri Lanka. And
yeah.
For sure. Hey, I think we need to take a short break. We're talking to Elizabeth Casals from Somash Fine Foods, and she's brewing another incredible tea that she's probably going to tell us about when we come back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Dolcezza Server Experience on Full Service Radio. Today we're talking to Elizabeth Casaus from Somage Fine Foods. Did I say that correct?
Yes.
And she's brewing more amazing teas for us. So what are you brewing, girl?
Okay, I brewed a second infusion of the Orange Osmanthus, which that's one of the really incredible things about tea is you can infuse it multiple times and it changes. So the second infusion of the Osmanthus, I think, is even better than the first because it kind of opens up and blooms and it's, would you like some more?
I would love more. I drink tea. I drink basically, Rob, how many cups of tea I drink per day?
You know, Bialetta and her mom drink like probably yes. like 5 to 8 cups of
tea. I drink tea all day long.
I love
all
that.
Day long.
Yeah. Yes. True. I'm also brewing the Assam Trace, which is a Taiwanese red tea, which is another way of saying black tea, but it does have kind of a reddish hue. That's grown in the Sun Moon Lake region. It's really special.
Are these your reserve selection teas?
Yes. So they're premium and reserve teas.
And these sell for like, I went to your website and I was like, whoa, there's like a $300 tea here.
Yes.
So
it's kind of like the coffee world as far as the different levels and the Grand Cru and
exactly.
the Geisha. Mm-hmm.
So we have something for everyone, you know, kind of at different levels, which is really awesome.
Right, right. Of course. Yeah. There's all prices there. So everyone can have amazing tea. But there's this rare teas we're drinking, lucky us.
Oh, your suitcase, your tea suitcase is like amazing.
Yeah, she's like the Houdini of tea.
Oh my gosh.
Thank you.
Yeah. Spike it.
So you mentioned coffee, so I want to talk coffee for a sec here.
Well, that's where we intersected with Elizabeth in our lives, with
Correct.
Coffee.
So you used to work for Stumptown, and Stumptown and Blue Bottle were sort of, you know, the pioneers of the third wave coffee, or some of them at least. And it's been in the last decade, right? It's been like a new golden era for coffee lovers. And this is thanks to companies like Stumptown, the one you worked for how long?
Just about 6 years.
6 years. How did you fall in love with coffee? How was that journey? And why is coffee so amazing?
Yeah, let's go back.
It's a fantastic question. So I graduated from Smith College in Western Massachusetts in 2005. And after that, I moved to Rhode Island with my partner at the time. I kind of got a random just day job and found that I came home every night and was baking. And I, you know, that was just my solace, was I was just baking and cooking and bringing things into friends and family. And I was always sitting on the counter with my mom growing up, cooking, you know, and just spending time with her. And
where did you grow up?
I grew up in sort of half between Connecticut and Cape Cod.
Okay.
And so I thought about it and I said, well, why don't I try going to culinary school? So I moved to New York to go to, then it was called the French Culinary School, French Culinary Institute. It's now the International Culinary Center, which is incredible. It's a really amazing place. And I began working at Jean Georges as an intern, and then I was a pastry cook there. I did the pastry program for about a year and a half. Really powerful experience, amazing learning, working under Johnny Uzzini. And then I decided to learn to make bread. So I fell in love with bread, and I worked for one of the most incredible bread bakeries in the world, Amy's Bread. And I eventually kind of made my way into their wholesale team.
Amy's Bread, was that in the Chelsea Market?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was when they had that massive space there,
right,
and you
which
could
is
walk
very
by.
Different now.
It is. But you could see the bread being made from start to finish when you walked by the windows. And as someone who's obsessed with learning how things work, that was a dream for me to learn all these things. And I wasn't a coffee drinker then, to be honest. I've got a massive sweet tooth, as you can imagine, being in pastry. And
me too.
Big time. You know, and I remember sort of one day being, that was some of the hardest work I ever did, right? I just felt myself burning through fuel. It was so physical, lifting dough, moving dough, cutting dough, everything, baking. And one day I went to the coffee station and I, you know, poured coffee in a cup and I tasted it and I almost spit it all out. You know, it's just so bitter, so strong. And I said, all right, well, I like sugar. I'll put a little sugar in there. Nope. Put some milk in there. Need some more milk, maybe some more milk, a little sugar. And then I said, this is not good for me. So I walked away. But I was walking around my neighborhood one day in Brooklyn and found a little coffee shop and went in and for some reason just got like a little iced latte or something. And it tasted really different than anything else. And I came back the next time and I got a drip coffee and I spoke to the barista and they were really friendly and the owner was friendly and the space was really cute. And I thought to myself, I feel happier when I leave here than when I came in. And it was the people, and it was the coffee, and it was unique. And so I started to read about coffee, and I had, you know, some really dear friends in the industry. Meister, who worked for Counterculture for a long time and works for Cafe Imports now. My friend Gabe Bascana, who's at Machina Coffee Roasters, was always, you know, sort of in the back of my mind. And my friend Charo, who worked for Murky Coffee in D.C. back in the day.
Shout out, Murky.
Yeah. Pioneers here in the area.
Yeah, amazing. A little coffee shop in an alley. And Nick worked there, too, actually.
Yeah.
Good. And, you know, they kind of said, check it out. And I went to some cuppings and learned about it a little bit. And then Stumptown was looking for a new sales rep. And I thought to myself, okay, I've mapped out New York because I've been helping with all the routing for Amy's Bread when I moved into their wholesale. And I have relationships with chefs and I love food and I love restaurants and I love people. I think I can take all these skills and apply it to coffee. And we just jammed. Like it was fun. And that was, you know, right after the Stubby was introduced. Like Stumptown was, I think, the first that was really making cold brew and bottling it. And they were doing everything by hand in a little weird factory in Red Hook. Scary.
We've been there.
So, well, it sounds familiar to where we're at right now. Not,
it's not
equating the two, but no. Like all downtown factory hand packing it and trying. Like, yes. The Stubby now is massive
far
as wholesale presence and all that. And that's kind of where we're trying to go.
It's
with
iconic.
The pints. Yeah. But that's how it starts.
Definitely. So, yeah, kind of through food, I guess, through my passion for food has led me to coffee.
So they were in New York at that time with the Ace Hotel.
Yes.
That was the cafe, or the only cafe that they had then.
That was the launch. Yep, was the Ace Hotel.
Were they roasting yet?
Yes.
In Red Hook, mm-hmm. right?
And they had a small base of wholesale customers. They were working with Keith McNally's group and, you know, some independent mom and pops. Definitely some you know, office coffee business. But, you know, in that 6 years, we grew really tremendously, especially in D.C. and Boston.
Back in that time, was Dwayne, the founder, Dwayne Sorensen, mm-hmm. was he still involved in the in New York and in the company?
He wasn't someone we saw a lot in New York, but he was heavily involved in the decisions and what was going on, and still very much the leader and the visionary.
Right.
So let's talk about coffee for a sec then. So I was reading about it and I didn't know that coffee has twice as much going on, molecularly speaking, as red wine. I was just blown away by it.
What you mean by that is like there's the flavor compounds, right?
Yes,
there's
more flavors, compounds, the notes,
that
the hints.
Go into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
And even more with tea, to be honest.
Oh, really?
Really?
There goes my tea girl now. She's not like,
well,
she's crossover.
Is it called phytochemicals? What would you do? Is there like or flavor chemicals, flavor compounds? Or are they all kind of mean the same thing?
Definitely.
Huh. Okay. Yep. That's fascinating. I didn't know that tea has more than coffee.
Tea is more complex. Yep.
Wow.
Huh. And the production is as well. The product, like the number of steps that you go through, it can be simplified to say, oh, maybe it's, you know, 10 steps to make the tea from a raw material into a dried tea.
Well, what you were
but
just talking about.
But you repeat it over and over and over and over
to make
it really good.
Breaking the leaf to expose or to, that's, yeah, I had no idea.
It's crazy.
So that sounds very labor consuming, right?
Some of it's all done by hand. Like the premium reserve teas, everything would be done by hand. For our classic selections, they're beautiful quality teas. But some of that is mechanized. But there still are so many hands and eyes that are looking over what's going on and ensuring the quality.
So it I don't know that people know that there's hundreds of varieties also of coffee trees, right? And mm-hmm. that matters as well. So, for example, one that we all love lately is the geisha, right? Which is, why is that so special?
Let Elizabeth say that. I think that she probably knows
it's
a lot more than I do.
Super unique, and that's one of those myths, which I don't think is a myth. It's probably a very true story. Is that Dwayne absconded with some geisha and brought it to Panama to some of Stumptown's partners there to grow some of the first geisha in South America. Really unique, but it's a rare varietal. So all of the varietals of coffee haven't been mapped, right? You know, when you're sourcing from Kenya and Ethiopia, oftentimes they're heirloom varietals, just like you think about your heirloom tomatoes or, you know, other fruits. They just grow in a forest. It's wild. But the geisha is interesting because it has a more floral and more delicate profile if you roast it in a way that really exposes that.
It's the first time that we ever tried that level of coffee, the Grand Cru coffee, and I think it was from the Panama coffee, the Panama geisha.
The Esmeralda,
exactly. I remember my expectations of what, because we being in the coffee industry, we heard so much about the geisha and the one from La Esmeralda, mm-hmm. is what it, the Panama La Esmeralda.
Yes.
And my expectations was I was going to get blown away by the action explosions and all that. But it was totally the opposite. And everybody's comment was, this is just like tea.
Yeah.
This is just like tea. Everybody compared
it. Very delicate.
It was the most delicate, balanced cup of coffee where it was so much that way that it was not like any cup of coffee. It was something else.
Right.
It was almost so not different that it was not coffee. It really, really shocked me.
It's amazing.
It was like, wow. It just totally redefined of, I guess, like, again, it's like what you think it's going to be, and it's completely the opposite.
Well, and if you didn't roast it as thoughtfully, you know, it would have had more of a roasty, toasty flavor to it.
Right.
And it would have seemed probably more, you know, coffee-like.
Right.
But that's one of the things, is the skill of the roasters is so key in, you know, bringing out the best.
And that's just roasting all the time, right? It's not that it's difficult. It's just that you need a lot of experience of doing it and doing it and doing it until you can just see the bean and know exactly what it needs, right?
It's paying attention. Yeah, it's like...
Yeah, it's detail.
It's done when it's done, right? So my wife is a chef, right?
Uh-huh.
And I'm a baker, mm-hmm. which for me, I love that. I grew up loving science. I love timers. I love recipes. I love knowing exactly what to do.
Especially in pastry.
In pastry, in coffee, right? You use your timer. You've got to get the grind size right. So when we cook together, I'll ask her questions. How long? What temperature this? And she'll tell me the temperature. But, you know, it's
she
a joke in our house.
High.
It's a joke in our house that it's done when it's done. You know, and she says, just smell it. You can smell it when it's done. And I used to get so angry at her, and I love her so much. I used to get so angry, and I was like, no, there's a recipe. Tell
what kind
me
of
it
truism is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, like, oh, you know, like she really taught me something in this. But it's true, right? I can be sitting across the room making pizza, and I can smell when it doesn't smell doughy anymore, when the cheese is browning. So it's the same thing with coffee. It really, you know, it's the same.
That's the same thing with
it's
everything,
Maillard reactions,
right?
And those Strecker-Decker reactions.
Yeah.
It's not the right way to say that, but...
You know, it's like you explaining that. It's the same thing with everything. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is that you're doing, I think there's a... I always want to try to achieve like the Zen relationship with it, you know, mm-hmm. which is a real true understanding for what it is that you're doing and fully be present for it all
Absolutely.
The time. You know, it's something that if one can learn to cultivate that approach, you can take that everywhere. You
well,
can apply
time.
It with everything.
Yeah, it's our most precious commodity now, which is time and focus.
Yeah.
Right? Whether it's, you know, putting the phone away, spending time with your girls.
Yeah.
Cooking, right? Taking joy in that, like, tranquility of cooking. And
when you can do that, it really... I was just having this conversation with our girls coming to school this morning, is when you have that attitude with it, it changes it.
Absolutely. Oh,
you know?
It's like putting
so
love
it's like
in something,
the magic.
Right?
It's the magic.
Yeah.
Reality in that sense is magic, as far as like it truly, truly matters the how.
Absolutely.
How do you do whatever it is that you do? And it affects that and it impacts that. Where if you don't give a shit about what you're doing, you have one result. Where if you really do care and put your time and attention into it, then it changes the output of it. And
well,
that's
it's your energy.
There's nothing more important than that.
No, it's your energy, right? Because if you put love into food and you put your energy into it, you know, if you're angry or if you feel like you've been wronged, it
impacts
it all. Like I trip when I'm angry.
Yeah.
I can't hold anger because I trip and fall and skin my knees, and I've never wanted to hold it, but when I do, I go, okay, sit down, take a deep breath.
Yeah.
Have a cup of tea.
Yeah.
No, and it translates to the companies that we're talking about. You know, the fact that Stomp Down like, sort of pioneered direct trade, and like no one was doing that. They went and talked to the farmer, empowered the farmer, did this, did that. And Somash is doing the same thing, has been doing it for so long at such a deep level. That's caring. That is putting love into what you're doing,
Absolutely.
Paying attention, trying to change things, connecting to people, mm-hmm. improving conditions. So there you go.
Yeah. You know, and do you feel like as of late, I don't know, that it gets hard, not that it gets harder to do that, but it just seems like not too many people, I don't know how to frame my question, but it just seems like with the internet and the amount of information that we get from all over the place, it changes that. Not it changes me or you or us and how we do it and why we do it. That doesn't, but it's like, it doesn't seem to be a lot of people doing stuff that way.
I agree. And
more chasing something else.
I think part of what you're trying to articulate is the challenge of walking the walk, right? And talking the talk. So really doing it, which is something that I my company is so amazing at, right? Like, I'm probably at the bottom of that list, but I'm inspired every day to, you know, be the best colleague I can be and respond faster and get in touch. And it's amazing. But with the world seeming so small with the internet and the ability to travel, it does seem like everyone's using the same buzzwords and everyone's sustainable and or saying that they're sustainable or direct trade or whatever that is. Whether or not that's true, I think it comes down to relationships and it comes down to how it feels, right? Yeah. You know, when you're sitting with somebody and all they want is the bottom line and then they want you to cut down 10% and then 5%. And maybe they haven't even seen your pricing yet, whatever it is. But you can tell when you're in alignment with somebody. And I'm grateful that I think, you know, we're in positions where we get to make those choices about who we want to work with and what feels good and what's going to be impactful.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something that, again, going back to our daughters, that we say is like, don't believe anything on surface value. Sit with it, mm-hmm. ask questions, find out and learn all that you can about it. Then make up your conclusion. And that
get to know your farmers, right? I mean, that's one of those things that you guys helped pioneer and has always inspired me, thinking about you driving, you know, up to what, Pennsylvania or Maryland to get your dairy?
York, PA.
For all those years. Yeah. You know, that's something and I still carry with
now,
me.
You know, these guys still, then now they drive down with every Thursday with a truckload full of the milk and the cream and now kind of expanding out to other farmers because the demand is growing, so we need to kind of widen that circle. So
yeah, it is.
It's really, really, really important.
And it's the hard way, right? Oh. I think that's something that keeps coming
to me. It is not
the
paved way that is there for you to sign the invoice from this distributor company.
You're blazing your trail. Yeah, you're not buying from a big mass market company. That's, I think, one of the biggest things about the work that we all do is it's the hard way.
Yeah.
It's blazing the trails and it's, you know, taking chances sometimes, but also knowing, you know, in your heart, in your soul, that you're doing the right thing.
And then you look at the way that those big coffee companies now, like Stumptown did, they blazed the trail and changed the coffee industry forever.
Absolutely.
And now look at specialty coffee and McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts. Before, you didn't have that.
No, I mean, this they're all is trying like, to get a piece of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, with hearing about the coffee supply of the world around the equator, that also the thing about the chocolate and the cocoa plants and all that is the same thing. Do you see happening in the tea trade? Like, are the plants and the supply of tea being not threatened, but you know, the demand is such that now people are talking about the problem of sourcing that good level of quality?
I don't think so, because they're most of the tea, you know, in the world is commodity tea, just like most of the coffee is commodity coffee.
Just most of the world is just commodity world.
Absolutely. You know? So I think we're not there with tea yet. And especially in America, you know, in the United States, we don't have the industry where, you know, I've seen in the past 12 months a big change, right? People are starting to pay a little more attention, but tea is still an afterthought to coffee.
Huh.
And so that's a lot of the work is talking to people and sharing things like this and sharing the stories, taking the time to show what the impact can be.
Give it time. It just seems like this whole thing of craft and quality is actually, as we talk and bash the market and the industry for commodity this, commodity that, at the same time, there is this swell, this groundswell of quality, I think, that's kind of coming up into all of the industry.
But you have to be holistic, right? You can't only, you know, as a company, and this is something that I think Stumptown did really well, and, you know, the folks that were sourcing and buying, you can't only buy their top 1%, because that's great, right? If you're going to pay them 3 times what they normally get. But if you're going to leave the rest of that stuff there, and it takes so much more labor and work to make that 1%, that's not sustainable. You need to find ways to really, truly support these people and these communities. You know, knowing what the farm gate price is, what it actually costs to make something, as opposed to, well, we paid twice the sea market price, whatever that is. It's the same in tea.
Yeah, and that's one thing that most people don't really understand and realize, for good reason. If you're on the outside, it's impossible to know what goes on the inside. But for us in gelato, for you guys in the tea production of it, for the coffee makers and all that, it's like the amount of cost, hands, process steps that go into it along the way is crazy. And so, you know, if there's complaints about that's so expensive or that price is high, if people could fully understand what goes into that, the making of that, then there may be a greater understanding. We had every Wednesday I sit down with the new hires at our factory to do a Dolcezza download.
Oh, wow.
And luckily, it's at the same time where our berry farmer, now that it's berry season, she's coming up from Hanover, Virginia in her van to deliver us the flats of strawberries and blueberries and blackberries. And so I bring her up to the table where I'm at the last 2 weeks, and she comes with her raspberries and her strawberries, and she says that. She's like, this is much more difficult for Dolcezza to get my berries.
Right.
It's much more expensive for them to get my berries. But for the last 11 years, we only have gotten her berries. Wow.
But then try my berries, and the berries are like mind-blowing.
Oh, and then they pass around the table, and every single kid there is blown away because they've never, ever had a raspberry or a strawberry like that. And that's the thing. That's the importance of it. And the thing is, it's her family, her sister, and her brother-in-law who owned the farm in Hanover, and so she's there working, and the kids and are now coming up to be the farmer hands and run the operations and everything.
Wow.
And that's the importance, is as we grow, we still work with them to try to help them make it, because the farmers and the small family businesses, it's like you said, it's not the easy way.
No, and a lot of companies would be buying, you know, the sort of step back from that, I think, is you'd be buying from a mainline distributor, right? Just berries.
Yeah.
Step back from that, that's fruit puree, right? Which is from, you know, could be all over the world, who knows? Could be adulterated, could have sugars added to it.
Step back from that, then you're getting flavors. Artificial flavors and stuff. And so that's the, and that is so dominant, and it's so etched in the world of industry. So it's really interesting to step into that and try to push back on it. So but it's important.
And that the youth, you know, teaching. That's one of those things that I'm really passionate about, seeing where we can all do more.
Boy, do we need to go somewhere else than where we're at right now. It's like, because what is here is on fire. Let it burn.
And on that note, we have to end the show.
Thank you, Elizabeth. We love you so much. And thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for the
tea. Thank you for enlightening us with your teas.
Yeah.
Beautiful days. And everyone, Elizabeth Casas from Somage Fine Foods, go check out the website, buy amazing tea. They source well. Be kind to one another. Happy Pride Week. What else do I have to say?
Love
each
rain.
Other.
Let it rain. Yeah.
Thank you so much. See you in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.